Chapter 16. Lysander. The 200. Sun bakes the tranquil parklands around the Roman ruins, but it is cool in the shade of the Colosseum. The morning events at Atalantia's summit of the 200 had started with summer showers, floral tea, handshakes, and power politics in the restored temple of Hercules Victor. There, I was able to sneak a moment with Horatia alone to tell her what must be done. With the Irons watching us, she hastily confirmed the dockyard's deal I teased to Valeria is already complete. She flashed me a holocube and we drifted our separate ways. Then, after the subsequent breakfast at the Temple of Juno, the heads of the guild houses made their ritual procession to the Colosseum for the main event. By then, the skies had cleared and a lazy, warm wind was already rolling in from the Italian interior. The outside of the Colosseum gleams white. A golden awning has been erected over the top. The inside of the Colosseum has also been refurbished for gladiatorial games Atalantia plans to host. But today, in place of the fighting sands, Atalantia has laid down travertine marble. Marble risers for the 200 sit beneath the actual viewing stands and lie in a U-shape at the north end. When one stands on the rostrum, an iron triangle on the floor, to speak, the irons are to the left, the moderates directly ahead, the reformers to their right, the rim delegation even further to the right, and the black chair of the dictator on the floor about 15 meters in front of the rostrum. After taking our seats, we heard a briefing regarding the Ascomani warlord of Volsung Far's raids on Republic strongholds in the asteroid belt, a welcome consequence of the Republic's chaotic internal divides. I sit, listening amongst Atalantia's hardliners, the diamond in her iron tiara. After the briefing, Cornelius Aucarthii assumes the rostrum. Cornelius, a loquacious and handsome man, uses all of his oratorial prowess to bemoan the injustice of the conflict still raging on the dockyards of Venus, indict the scurrilous character of Apollonius, and extol the virtue of his family's show of arms even while begging the 200 to help them defeat a numerically inferior foe. "With millions of men under arms, we Carthii will not lose. But Apollonius is cementing his place in the pantheon of premier field commanders by ripping the men we send against him to bloody shreds. Surely ship production is a common cause. Surely property rights still matter. The truth is plain as day to everyone listening. Those docks were built by us, kept by us, they are ours, but needed for the common good." Cornelius surrenders the rostrum with a plea for unity and respect for law and order. The irony of these sentiments coming from a haughty Carthii is reflected in the little smiles shared around the room. The fourth sitting next to me in the irons leans over with a whisper of contempt. The Carthii stuck their perfumed hand in the Minotaur's mouth, and he's dragging their whole house into his labyrinth bit by bloody bit. Hilarious. I give him a slight smile and sigh at Cornelius's impending political decapitation. What's that old maxim? Be wary of tyrants. They will help you today and own you tomorrow. Atalantia doesn't even need to rise from her black chair of office to ruin Cornelius's life and demote one of the great houses of the conquering to a middling power. Cornelius, you could not be more correct. Ship production is crucial to the functioning of this state. A vote will only delay decisive action, and decisive action is needed. Therefore, I have personally dispatched 10 legions to deal with this threat to the society. I will bear all costs and all risks. Cornelius, tell your father Asmodeus to worry not. The dockyards will soon be in safe hands. Cornelius and his siblings pale. By month's end, their 600-year-old family heirloom will belong to Atalantia, exactly the fate I helped Heliopolis to avoid. The fools can't even challenge Atalantia's jurisdiction. They handed their inheritance to her on a platter. No gratitude for our Grimace's generosity. Scipio Aufolth asks Cornelius from amongst his phalanx of hard-bitten siblings. Cornelius eats the mouthful of shit, swallows, and thanks Atalantia for it. Her iron block snickers. The reformers purse their lips. The Rim deputation look at each other, smug at the comparative dignity of their moon council.
Julia, who is next on the docket? Atalantia asks.
Storm Knight of the Rim Dominion, the rostrum is yours, Julia calls.
Diomedes Aura stands from his place between his mother Dido and his mentor Helios, and trudges up to the rostrum. He begins without preamble and delivers the butcher's bill for the last 2 months of warfare, with his head lowered like a ram. Diomedes is not a very good public speaker. Thicker than most of his colleagues from a life of high-gravity training, it's obvious what the raw air was made to do, and it wasn't to stand at a rostrum and sway hearts and minds. Politics and rhetoric were supposed to have been the destiny of Diomedes's brother, Aeneas. Diomedes's destiny was to be his family's fist. When Aeneas died at the Battle of Ilium, fighting many of the men and women who now recline in the shade above Diomedes, Diomedes was thrust toward a future he neither expected nor wanted. Then his father, Romulus, died too, and he became heir to a legacy 750 years old. Great expectations follow Diomedes. Chafing at that, and at the sophisticated airs of his audience, his words come like bullets. From under heavy brows, his eyes glare accusations searing enough to set togas on fire. When he finishes his report, he scowls up at Atalantia and her ironblock hardliners as if they, not the Republic, were responsible for the casualties. I am not spared his ire. After our talk in the theatre, he does not appreciate my seating arrangement. He will see it as a grotesque hypocrisy. If I thought I saw an ally in him in the theatre based on his embarrassment at Helios's manners, it is confirmed by his obvious disappointment in me. Like all other core golds, I say one thing and do another. Snipe at Atalantia, sit in her section. I glance at Horatia, who sits with the small reformer block, and feel nauseated. Diomedes does not surrender the rostrum as he should. He remains on the iron triangle in the center of the marble floor, glaring at Atalantia. She watches back from her chair of office, as does Ajax from his place with the Olympics on the wings of the speaking floor, and so do the hooded crows in the circular gap in the awning's center, high above. Atalantia cocks her head in amusement.
Diomedes, first to storm the twin railguns, then on to Earth to take the Middle East from the Red Sea to the Black, then to Ceres and the Belt, then all the way back to Earth. By Jove, young dragon, you've the wings of Hermes on your boots.
Atalantia pauses. Smiles.
This must be the longest you've remained rooted to one spot since you arrived.
The laughter is not limited to Atalantia's block. It spreads into the more populous moderates in the centre, where even Julia Albalona smiles at Diomedes's expense. The reformers to Diomedes's right, by far the minority, think the joke in poor taste. I catch Horatia's eye. She gives me three quick blinks. Our signal. After our talk at Hercules Victor, she made her move at the Temple of Juno. Everything is prepared. My nausea deepens as I think of Cleirastes curled on the floor of a dog kennel, waiting to see if I love him as much as he loves me. Dido parts from her fellow consul, Helios, and replaces her son on the rostrum. It's good Helios is not speaking. After a preview of his manners in Heliopolis, the last thing we need is our own day of red doves. Dido is a profoundly handsome woman with charisma to spare. Strong features, penetrating eyes filled with mischief, thick hair of dark gold, and, peculiar for a consul of the Rim, she is bawdy, jocular, even funny. But it's her temper that's always been her liability.
Atalantia, I can speak for us all when I say your boots are horribly lovely.
Atlantia's boots are as marvellous as they are obnoxious. Black leather from a Stygian cobra encrusted with great diamond skulls.
Yet I swore war was in fashion, not diamonds.
Atalantia looks suddenly far less bored than when Cornelius held the rostrum. She doesn't miss a beat.
The skulls started as carbon. Perhaps it is the pressure of carrying the war that has made them diamonds. Go on, then, Ausaud. Oh, excuse me, Aura. Lecture us if you're the one that's been fighting the Rising for, what, 12 years now, while we've been hiding behind our moat?
She smiles.
You paid a dear price to enter this war. How strange to flinch at casualties now.
The room winces. The casualty of which Atalantia so casually speaks was Dido's husband, who chose to die both in protest of the war and because he hid evidence of Darrow's destruction of the dockyards of Ganymede from the Moon Lords, in violation of his honour.
The same Romulus famous for his passionate fairy tale love for Dido,
who died in the end because Dido pressed for war.
I hear young Seraphina was a virtuosic fighter and a credit to her father and mother, and her people as a whole,
Atalantia says, in reference to Dido's daughter, who died in the fighting on Mercury.
I saw her simply disappear when a rail slug hit her.
Technically, she was the Rim's first casualty. The Colosseum goes dead silent.
I've seen razor duels with less tension.
Dido sighs, and I wonder if her opening taunt was bait to lure this disproportionate response from Atalantia.
I think it was. At the price of much hardship, Dido has gained an air of wisdom and gravitas, and by choosing to ignore Atalantia's insults, she now seems the true statesman of the two, which Atalantia doesn't seem to mind.
Dido continues. We should not forget the great peoples we few here represent. Billions wait for us to sort the troubles that disturb our age. Time and again, you have preached a message of unity, our Grimus. Promises of aid against the ecliptic guard. Promises of aid in the asteroid belt. Promises of aid in the matter of Ceres. Then what of that aid? What of that unity? I saw here today with my own eyes how quick you are to dispatch legions to deal with your own troubles. But what of our shared troubles? Time and again, our Grimus, we have extended our hand only to be left grasping at air. Did we not aid you in liberating Earth? Did we not conquer Ceres upon your request? So why are your boots still stuck in the mud when it comes to the matter most dear to us? As you rebuild your cities, stack your spoils, polish your boots, the rest of us, fewer in bodies, poorer in monies, suffer to pay the bill. We are left to wonder why this is. Poor communication, hidden agendas, greed, laziness, or perhaps it is simply that habit has taught the leaders of the Corps that Rim lives are expendable. That was true once, when the Rim was shackled to the Society. It is no longer true. Instead, what is true is that you need us. What is true is that we are not your vassals. We do not jump when you say jump. We do not die when you say die. But we will leave this alliance if you persist in this obstinacy, this disrespect and brinksmanship against those you profess to be your allies.
Scipio O'Folth calls out,
The Honorable Consul of the Dominion is quite correct. How selfish of us to rebuild our cities! If only we could be more like the Dominion, and not have to rebuild a single one.
A reformer next to Horatia fires back,
If only the Honorable Folth did not think all cities should be pounded to a fine dust, we might not have to rebuild anything but the trust of the people in us.
A general firefight ensues. The Senate was never as solemn in closed sessions as it pretended to be to the public. Neither is the 200. formed around the same rules, the Senate and the 200 have the same manners. In both bodies, beings with genius-level intellects are reduced to hollering like gladiatorial crowds in some asteroid backwater, shaking performative fists, reeling back in indignation, and sharpening rhetorical harpoons to thrust into an adversary or draw a smile from their patron. The commotion only quiets when Julia Aubelona, the Princeps Senatus, stands and hammers her pyramid-tipped staff of office on her riser. As the leader of the 200, Julia keeps its rules and, along with the Olympic Knights, enforces them.
We're already an hour behind the day's schedule. If the esteemed dictator does not remind her friends that we are not paying coyotes but peerless scarred, I will skip the lunch recess and fine every member responsible for my low blood sugar. Yes, that includes you, Scipio. Quit blathering and let the woman talk. You might have more legions than hair follicles, but she has the floor.
Atalantia flicks a finger, and her block quiets. Dido carries on. The agreement made between your government and mine, when we entered this war, was that Mars would be the main military target. That Luna, the seat of tyranny, would be your responsibility to reclaim, not ours. You agreed to these terms, Atalantia. You signed these terms, Atalantia. And yet, every time we request to begin the campaign against Mars, you prevaricate. A shadow cast by something above wags on the floor in front of her. I follow her eyes up to the gap in the awning, where Atlas sits far above the summit, legs dangling off a support strut. The crows perched up there don't seem to mind him one bit. Dido is flustered by the unexpected appearance of her brother-in-law, but not for long.
What am I to tell the mothers and fathers of the Rim that their children died for, Atalantia? What am I to tell the grey and blue Archons their caste members died for, Atalantia? As this war drags on, what excuse shall I give? We did not attack Mars because your friends were too busy shoring up their own domains? We did not attack Mars because you had to rebuild your capitals, and your pet fiancé must host games while we did the dying.
Dido's eyes meet mine. She does not veil her disgust with my place in Atalantia's block.
That we were used by the Corps and then tossed away like a street tramp.
Time and again, you preach a method of unity, Aughrimus. Today you have an opportunity to prove that Corps golds keep their word. Today we have the ships. Together we have the legions. Declare the campaign for Mars, and let us finish the rising once and for all.
She looks at the most famous isolationist in the room, Helios, and gives a hard nod to show their unity.
If you do not, then you must not need us, and we will have no choice but to assume this alliance dissolved and sail back to our own worlds.
Dido returns to her seat beside her son to strong applause from Horatia and the reformers.
That concludes the Rim deputation's time, Julia says.
Atalantia begins to stand.
Not yet. Protocol, Atalantia. You know the floor must first be open to the body.
Thank Jupiter we have you, Julia. I'm always in such a rush to just get things done.
Atalantia swans back down. If anyone wants to waste their breath advocating for the Rim, now is the time. No one dares. Not even the reformers. That is a crucial part of the theater Horatia has arranged.
Atalantia takes one of the asps slithering around the arms of her chair of office and dons it like jewelry. She doesn't once spare me a glance to see if I intend to speak, secure in her conviction that I don't have the stomach to consign Glerastes to death. Seated down with the other Olympic knights, Ajax looks relieved. He offers me a smile of conciliation. He knows defeat only too well. As the silence stretches, it becomes awkward and then oppressive. More and more people begin to look around. I can sense there are others like me out there, those who chafe under Atalantia's yoke, but she's silenced some of them. Those she has not silenced, Horatia has silenced. Many of the house heads who know my true opinion on the matter look at me and wonder why I do not speak. But most of them, while powerful, are fence-sitters, not deeming the matter worth the risk one way or the other. Still, the fence-sitters would have expected me to lend my opinion. I have been very vocal for this very reason. My silence would not have mattered in a room filled with remonstrations from the reformers, but now it thunders. The venom drains out of the looks from Diomedes and Dido as they begin to construct their own narrative for the room's silence. I improvise a little and flick my eyes up to Atlas, just for half a second. Several dozen people see and look. Helios is one of them. Then more look at Atlas. Then half the assembly is looking up to the gap in the awning at the man hanging over the silence like the sword of Damocles. It is a perfect answer as to the nature of the silence that grips the assembly. It seems to all as if everyone else has been cowed into silence. Atalantia turns to look at me with a puzzled expression, but I remain the picture of fidelity to her. She squints around the room.
Nothing from you, Horatia? No quibbling from your morally august flock?
Horatia plays it up by looking down. Atalantia is starting to get angry. Like she said, she depends on dissent. Subjugation is not a good look in a crowd as pathologically competitive as this. A dictator is the highest peer, but a peer still. She looks like a sovereign. Worse, a queen.
Quiet bunch today, Julia. May I speak now?
Atalantia asks. Julia waves her on. Atalantia uncoils herself from her black chair of office to give what all have come for, her plan for the next stage of the war.
My noble counterpart from the rim speaks with wisdom hard learned. Yes, Dido, she says, clutching at her own heart. I feel your anger, your rage for Mars. The flames lick at my heart as they licked at my father's skin when Darrow and Apollonius burned him in his bed. But we cannot run from hard truths. My friends, the hard truths are what we must address today. I hope it steals your heart to know that I concur. Yes, a rain must fall on Mars.
Her supporters thump their benches all around me. I abstain.
The ecliptic guard must be smashed. Augustus rooted out from her father's old den. Julii pulled down from her moon roost. Every traitor must be tried and hanged, their sling blades beaten into collars. Aegeus stormed, the helium liberated. But, she says amongst the cheers of her supporters, but the hard truth is, if you turn your back on a wild boar to kill the lion, the only thing you'll bring home is a tusk through your thigh. That is why, yes, yes, Mars must fall, and after Luna, she will. Her supporters fill the Colosseum with a roar of support that sends the crows in the Attico scattering. Alone now, in the high perch, Atlas watches me, watching him. He tilts his head. Which is why,
the cheers quiet as Atalantia lifts her hand. I have accepted Lysander Auloon's petition to lead the vanguard of the Lunar Reign along with the legions of the Gens Forth. 6 months from now. So that when Luna is reclaimed and the society restored, there will once again be a loon upon the Palatine. Her hardliners applaud me and turn to shake my hand. Diomedes has had enough. He stomps down to the speaking floor and stalks out. If they'd planned to stage a walkout, Dido or Helios should have been the one leading it. Nonetheless, they nod to the others and begin to follow the Storm Knight out.
My dreams of a united society will burn before my eyes if I stay seated. I clock Horatia. She nods. Now is the moment. All is arranged.
When he sees what I am about to do, fear grips Ajax. He steps forward from his station with the Olympics, his hand outstretched, imploring me to stay safe on my knees in Atalantia's cage with him. Instead, I stand.